enough at some point. But this week I've been reflecting a fair amount on what's called the two guardians of the world. The Buddhist tradition has these two things called the two guardians of the world. And you would think that they'd be quite lovely, wonderful concepts. But when you first hear them, sometimes they're a little bit troublesome for Westerners. Partly it's because of the Victorian English, who translated Buddhism into English. The choice of words was not always so appropriate necessarily, but the two guardians of the world in Victorian English were shame and moral dread. And when I was practicing in Thailand with my first Vipassana teacher, I asked him once about his own practice background and why he started practicing. I think he became a monk when he was in his late teens or 20 or something. And it came back through the translator, oh, because of shame and moral dread. And I said, boy, I don't know people who get involved. No one gets involved in Buddhism because of shame and moral dread, at least as far as I know. The words are hiri and otapa. Let's say a few things before going into them. The central practice that we're doing is the practice of paying attention, of mindfulness. In the Dhammapada, this opening of the second chapter begins, attention is the path to the deathless. Inattention is the path to death. Those who are attentive will never die. Those who are inattentive are as if already dead. There's something very special about attention in Buddhism, that the qualities of timeless presence, the qualities of being mindful and attentive, that is very rewarding in the present moment, is very precious. And one of the things we discover as we bring our attention, pay careful attention to what we do in the present, is we discover the tremendous momentum or tremendous movements of going against things and wanting and going for things, pushing things away or holding on to things. Tremendous momentum of liking and disliking, wanting and not wanting, wanting and hating. And many of us are buffeted about by these preferences we have, by these reactions and responses we have. And if we pay very careful attention, it can be quite a surprise for some people to discover how much their minds and hearts are constantly being buffeted about by what they want and don't want, what they want to pay attention to, what they don't want to pay attention to, what they're willing to talk about and what we're not willing to talk about, and the family secrets that no one wants to talk about, maybe they turn away from, or there's many, many things that we don't want to look at, and many things that we choose to look at because of our preferences. And what we try to do with attention, with our awareness in Buddhist practice, is not let our awareness be governed by our preferences, likes and dislikes, but rather to develop attention so we can see clearly what is happening here in the moment, exactly as it's happening, as opposed to what we want to happen or what we hope would happen, or whatever way we kind of tweak or manipulate the present moment. So the ability to see clearly how things actually are outside of our preferences is a very powerful, important part of Buddhist practice. So one of the things we discover, as I said, is that we discover how much we kind of reject things or how much we hold on to things in our awareness. It's not necessarily bad to reject some things or hold on to certain things, but if our attention is constantly governed, ruled by those preferences, then we're not free. So as we pay attention, as attention develops, we discover a kind of presence, a kind of way of being present in life, which is independent of all these preferences, all these likes and dislikes. And it can feel quite liberating to discover that kind of presence. It can feel quite wonderful, because the ways in which we feel often oppressed, and the ways we often feel anxiety and worry, have to do with when we can't be present in a clear way for what's actually happening, but are in the process of pushing away, holding on to things. And so it can be a surprise how much we do that, and it can be also a surprise how wonderful it is to discover a presence which is at peace and not buffeted about by the preferences. And this wonderful peace, underneath our preferences and in the nature of attention itself, then leads many Buddhists, especially here in the West, to have, when they teach about the human nature, to kind of stress the fundamental goodness of human beings. And they often then also, and as part of this, will put a tremendous emphasis on acceptance. Mindfulness practice is about accepting ourselves, accepting life as it is, and being very kind to ourselves, being very forgiving. Forgiveness is a very important part of, especially the American Vipassana scene. And all those things are wonderful, and all those things are the strength of those kinds of teachings in the American Dharma scene has a lot to do because of the strength of the opposite in the American culture. A lot of Americans are very unaccepting of themselves, have a lot of conflict with themselves, are often adversarial relationships to themselves. So teaching acceptance, teaching kindness, and teaching about our fundamental goodness is very helpful for people, many people in our culture. However, it can lend itself, this kind of teaching, if it's taken too simplistically, to the notion that you should never have any kind of uncomfortable inner feelings about yourself. You should never have any kind of feelings of shame or regret or remorse. That it can lend itself to the idea that, oh, if I'm feeling a little bit off about what I've done, I'm not at peace, I haven't accepted myself, so let's just kind of forget about what the event was, and let's just accept myself and be at peace here. Let's just forgive myself really quickly. And kind of turning away from any kind of discomfort without learning how to settle into it and respect it, maybe see what the value might be there. And this is particularly true with these things, unfortunately called shame and moral dread. So my preferred translation is conscience and fear of consequences. And these are called the guardians of the world. Now, if we do something that causes harm to others, and it could be very mild, it could be very strong that we do something, then it's normal, it's healthy to feel some remorse, to feel like something is a little bit off in the universe, something's going wrong here on many fronts. And one front, because if you've harmed someone and you're in touch with that, you kind of feel kind of a little bit, uncomfortable inside, or very uncomfortable inside for having harmed someone else. Also, if the action is somewhat intentional, or comes from our own ignorance, then we might feel a bit, uncomfortable with ourselves now. Oh, I have this possibility of causing harm to others. It's part of me that's ignorant, that I'm not inattentive about, that I need to bring more attention to. And I feel uncomfortable with that part of myself, that habitual way of responding. So part of the reason why I've been thinking about this week is that I found myself this week having said three different occasions, having said something relatively mild, I would suppose, depends, where two of the times someone called me on it, said, that wasn't quite right, and one of the times maybe they didn't even notice, but I noticed later, and I felt I felt uncomfortable, I felt bad about what I'd done, and so there's a certain level of discomfort and certain level of I don't like the word shame, but certain level of feeling kind of uncomfortable with the situation, kind of off, and wanting to make amends, wanting to reconcile, wanting to apologize, wanting to do something about that. And if I had quickly gone and say, just kind of forgiven myself or overlooked it because of some simplistic idea that I'm supposed to just kind of accept things as they are and be in peace no matter what happens, then I'm shortchanging myself. There is, it reminds me of this story when I was 20. And I had a little bit of contact by that time with Buddhism and spiritual practice and done some practice. And I was a hippie hitchhiking around in communes in the United States with a girlfriend. And I had the notion, or I had the practice, that everything was fine. No matter what, everything was fine. And so she lost her flashlight. And my attitude was, everything's fine. What's the problem? And, you know, she wanted to find her flashlight. And I said, well, you know, everything's fine. And she got pretty angry with me. And I think justifiably. I mean, everything's fine, but it doesn't mean you can't go look for the flashlight. Simplistically, we can kind of we can use spirituality sometimes as a way of avoiding what is uncomfortable, or avoiding our responsibility in life. And when we look at these terms, hiri and otapa, conscience and fear of consequences, that the Buddha taught, it's probably useful to remember that the Buddha came from a warrior class. He was there was all these castes in ancient India, and he came from the castes of the warriors. And traditionally, warriors tend to have a lot of self-respect, especially when there's a whole kind of culture around being a warrior. And the idea of hiri and otapa is the idea is that they represent forms of self-respect. That if you really respect yourself, then you're going to feel, when you've done something wrong, something that's, you'll feel bad about that. You'll feel bad about yourself. You'll feel a certain amount of discomfort, a certain amount of, maybe shame is not a terrible word. I don't know. I keep wanting to come out of my mouth here. But there's a degree to which we have self-respect for ourselves that we can then feel off if we have done something to harm someone else, especially if it's been intentional or based on our ignorance. One of the situations this week was where I said, where I should have known better. I've certainly given a lot of thought and talked to other people about this issue, but somehow in the conversation, for me, just kind of in the meeting, it just kind of slipped out in a kind of sloppy way. I was at a meeting of different Bay Area Buddhist groups, both Asian ethnic groups and kind of groups like us, whatever we are. And I was talking about how wonderful it was to be in this kind of situation, because groups like us hardly ever encounter the ethnic Buddhists. We don't have much interface with them, for many of us. And it's nice to kind of feel a kinship with our fellow Buddhists in the Bay Area. And I was actually quite inspired by this Vietnamese teacher from Hayward, who was there at the meeting. But in saying that, I talked about the divide between, it tends to be between the ethnic Buddhists and the Caucasian Buddhists. And I just said it without thinking about it. And then as we went around the table and different people speaking, a number of people pointed out, there's my very inappropriate use of the word Caucasian for a number of reasons. Not least of which is one of the people who was there at the meeting, who I was kind of including in the so-called Caucasian category, was an African American. And I went afterwards and apologized to him, and he hardly noticed. I think he's, you know, so used to it. I felt really bad about having chosen a word that might have hurt someone else. And hopefully it's from my self-respect for myself that I want to take a look at that and try to be more careful with my language in the future, and not to kind of limit, the kind of Buddhism I'm involved in, the kind of convert Buddhism is often called, but even that's kind of problematic. Kind of limited to Caucasians, even though we're kind of Caucasians tend to be the biggest groups of in our particular circles of Buddhism. So I felt bad, and I think I feel it was appropriate to feel bad about that. What was interesting was it was a little more complicated, though, because I could see that part of my discomfort was, I think, natural or appropriate to the situation, and I felt a certain amount of remorse and regret and wanted to apologize, wanted to look at that part of the way I used different words. But also, part of what I could feel was a fear of rejection from the people there, fear of their judgment of me. And it would be very easy to get those two entangled, whereas, that's a whole different animal, in a sense, the fear of rejection or fear of being judged. And I don't think I need to walk around and carry those kinds of fear or be concerned about it. But just because some of it's mixed up with that kind of a little bit more self-preoccupied anxiety about how other people accept me, didn't mean I have to reject then the what I'm talking about originally, the feeling of sort of my remorse for what I did. So if we have some idea that spirituality is only about feeling good about ourselves, or only about feeling good and always being full of kindness and love, it's possible we'll shortchange ourselves and not allow ourselves to feel the appropriate remorse or regret or kind of discomfort which needs to be there if you've done something that you regret or have remorse about, if you caused someone some harm. And part of being settled in the present moment, being with our attention and not resting in our preferences, is to then learn how to rest in that discomfort, that kind of discomfort, learn just to be present for it and to learn from it and develop from it. If we don't have Buddhist teachings or practice around such issues tends to be forward-looking rather than backward-looking. And forward-looking means we take our situations we've done and we have some regret about, and we don't harp on them, we don't kind of linger with them in order to feel bad about ourselves, but rather we look at them and see, well, how can I do better in the future? What can I do to improve myself here so I don't use this again, don't do this kind of activity again? And then in that future kind of thinking, using our imagination, using our creative ability to think the future, there's this other category called fear of consequences. And this is also a very important one of the guardians of the world, that we have some concern about, some consideration about what the consequences are of our actions. That if we're going to do something, what are those consequences? Is this going to hurt someone? Is this going to hurt ourselves? What is this going to do to our self-respect? What is this going to do to our sense of personal integrity? And I know that I've certainly over my lifetime or years considered doing some activities which I thought would have been, from one point of view very nice to do, maybe very pleasant to do, lots of pleasure, but when I think about the consequences of it, some of the various ramifications of what might happen, and also of the kind of the underlying emotions for that kind of pleasure or whatever, that kind of desire, there's a kind of feeling of pulling back, a kind of resistance or kind of recoiling. I don't want to get close to that. That would be a violation of my integrity. That feels like that would harm someone. And so there's a kind of a recoiling, a pulling back that seems quite appropriate. So this idea of being balanced in the present moment and not moving forward and backward, being completely open in our attention, shouldn't then not allow us to actually feel a certain kind of recoiling, healthy recoiling, from the possibility of doing something that harmful to others. I think that comes as we become more sensitive, as we develop our attention more and develop this ability to not rest in our preferences, but rest rather in awareness itself, that I think that there's a healthy sense of kind of recoiling when we feel a motivation or compulsion to do something which our better nature, our conscience says, this is not quite right. I've observed that I've been involved in two Buddhist communities here in the Bay Area. The Vipassana community, it's kind of a through Spirit Rock, and then the San Francisco Zen Center in San Francisco, and Green Gulch and Tassajara. And it's interesting to sometimes compare different the emphasis in different groups. Not necessarily put a value on it, but it helps. Sometimes you learn about yourself by understanding the other. And so I noticed at some point that in the Spirit Rock Vipassana scene, there's a tremendous emphasis on forgiveness, which, you know, is a beautiful thing. To be able to forgive is one of the great virtues. And I've been very inspired by some of the more dramatic stories in the news and various and people I know. Forgiveness has been, you know, extended in situations that seem very difficult. But over and over again, the emphasis at Spirit Rock has been forgiveness. And in this kind of covering the same, when at the San Francisco Zen Center, when they kind of cover the same kind of range of human phenomena, they never talk about forgiveness there. It's not, you know, and what they talk about there a lot is confession. But they never talk about confession at Spirit Rock. Partly because I think confession has this idea that, oh, something's wrong with me. And I have to kind of confess, fess up, you know, what I've done that's wrong. It's kind of like to look at yourself in kind of a negative way or bad way or uncomfortable way, or rather than seeing yourself as only someone who's fundamentally good. And so, in seeing that contrast between the two of them, I made the reflection in our kind of Vipassana scene that perhaps we don't give enough space, enough credence and importance to confession, to allowing ourselves to see ourselves, both our fundamental goodness, which I think is there, but also to in relationship to that goodness, just to appreciate the ways in which we might violate our own integrity and ways in which we might cause harm to others, and appropriately feel bad about that, and maybe linger with that feeling of badness for a while to learn from it and develop from it, and perhaps to go to someone and apologize and say, I'm sorry for what I did. So that's enough for me today. I think that's my thoughts on this topic. It's partly my confession. My three different things I said this week, which I don't feel good about having said or done. Actually, one of them was through email. So I didn't say it, but I wrote it. It was interesting there with the email, because it was actually complete ignorance. I just didn't know the etiquette of how people write email. I had written I was replying to someone and wrote his name, dear so-and-so. And I've noticed a lot of people don't write names on top of email messages, but I'm still kind of old-fashioned, you know, dear so-and-so. And then he had sent the message out to a whole group of people. So I'd never done reply all before. I don't quite know how this stuff works, you know. So I'm a little bit, you know, email illiterate still. So I saw that button and said, reply all. I wonder if, you know, maybe if I do that, then everyone else will kind of get a CC and kind of see what happens. So I did reply all. And then I wrote dear so-and-so and wrote my, because I was really writing it to him, not to everyone, but I thought everyone else should see it. But anyway. And then I got this angry letter back, email back saying, something like, you're always only talking to him, and you're always overlooking the rest of us. And here is email; it goes to everyone, and you're only saying, "Dear's you," you know, that guy, and you know, how could you? I was like, what? I was writing to him. I just thought, I didn't know how this works. So, I understand why the person was hurt, and I realized it had to do with my ignorance. I think, if I knew the etiquette of email culture, I wouldn't have done it the way I did it. But I didn't know the etiquette yet. Now I know something about it. So I didn't feel like I'd actually necessarily done something wrong, but what I'd done had caused someone hurt. Someone else, for their reasons, was felt hurt. And so in that situation, my sense of feeling discomfort was feeling somehow the empathy with that person. With talking about the Caucasian thing, There I felt real remorse in myself and what I'd done. I should know better than that, to use that word in that kind of context that I was using it. And partly was, you know, concerned about what kind of hurt I've caused someone else at the meeting, but much more was like looking at myself. Oh, I felt like I'd stabbed myself, you know. Oh, in a situation where I should know better. In my ignorance, I've really done something here which was inappropriate. Anyway, enough for me. So, what should we do here? What I think we should do, if you are, will forgive me, is I think this hopefully was an interesting topic for all of you. And if you would maybe turn to two or three people sitting right near you, maybe people you don't know so well, and talk a little bit about what kind of reactions you've had to this particular kind of this talk, how you reflected on it, what you thought about it, or what you didn't like about it, what your protests about it, or whatever. Is that okay with you all?
Can you say one more thing? What Guardians of the World? Could you define like the contest that was stated in or something? It's sort of interesting.
Or the Guardians of the World.
Yes.
Oh, I think it protects the world from horrible things. It's when people don't have those two things that that we can have war and violence and all the things that we have. So when we have them, the world is protected. So is this okay that I ask you to do this?
No.
I haven't transgressed. Might cause undue. Probably for some of you, I've caused undue discomfort now. But if my job was to never cause discomfort in my students, then I wouldn't do my job. So I have to allow for some of that. So if you don't mind, find another person or two other people and have a minute's little discussion about this topic.
You should know that in our bylaw we cannot dismiss such things.